Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adam Winkler, who's a professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a contributing writer for The Daily Beast, Huffington Post, and Newsweek. He's the author of the new book just out, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Rights to Bear Arms in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Winkler.
Thanks for having me.
And clearly with a presidential candidate who happens to be a front runner on the Republican side, himself very pro-gun, do you expect guns to be an issue in this coming election year, even though it seems that the Democrats have been assiduously avoiding gun control for the last several years?
I fully expect gun control to be an issue in the next election. Gun owners are very motivated and very activated in this era. Right now, the big scandal that they're focusing on is this Fast and Furious scandal. This is the botched sting operation that led to the U.S. government essentially selling guns to the Mexican drug cartels and allowing those guns to walk without following them. So I think for sure there is going to be a real interest among gun owners in the next election.
But surely, Adam Winkler, the Fast and Furious so-called scandal is a fraudulent scandal, at least to my mind. Daryl Issa has drummed it up. The Republicans are jumping on it, probably as a way to go after the Clinton administration. I know there have been various statements about how high it goes up the chain, and it seems to be a kind of fishing expedition in that regard. How can the Congress and congresspeople who have endorsed the Tired Amendment that prevents any information, the very information that the ATF needs to share with local law enforcement, they're prohibited. So there seems to be more than a measure of hypocrisy here.
There's a certain irony in that those who are objecting the most to the Fast and Furious scandal are also the ones who insist that we do the least to stop the flow of guns to Mexico. So there's no doubt that there's a certain irony, but I don't think this scandal is going away, in part because I do think the Obama administration hasn't handled it very well. They have really refused to come up with information and reveal information to the investigating committees about what exactly happened here, why were these guns allowed to go to Mexico without being followed. Personally, I don't think there's any problem with the sting operation. The police do this all the time. The problem is, we need to know why did these guns go to Mexico without being followed, and whether it's a make-believe scandal or not, that certainly has never stopped political opponents from harping on some scandalous issue in the past.
But isn't the record pretty clear about the, particularly the supporters of the NRA, which is basically both sides of the House? One of the strategies of the NRA has been to weaken the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, the ATF. And they haven't had anybody in charge of the ATF now for, I think, a decade or so, and that still seems to be the case. The president's nominee is in limbo. Isn't this, I think, a little extra dose of hypocrisy as well?
Well, I guess that's right. There's one thing I found in researching my book Gunfight that you mentioned earlier is how many interesting twists and ironies there are in the story of guns in America. The truth is guns are a far more complicated subject than either of the extremes in the gun debate have really made clear. One of the funny things I found in researching Gunfight is that the NRA used to be the biggest supporter of gun control. They weren't always the diehard no-compromises opponent that we know today. And in fact, in the 1920s and 30s, the NRA was at the forefront of the gun control movement, drafting restrictive gun control laws and promoting them in state after state. In fact, I talk about in the book, when Congress was considering the first major federal gun control law in the 1930s, the president of the NRA was asked to testify before Congress and was asked whether it violated the Second Amendment. His quote, his response is pretty astounding today. He said, quote, "I have not given it any study from that point of view." So the story of the NRA is one of constant shifts and often some funny ironies. The NRA is now seeking to overturn some of those same laws that it promoted back in the 1920s and 30s.
Again, I'm speaking with Adam Winkler, the author of a new book just out, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Now, the story begins, your story begins, with the recent case in a ruling on the Second Amendment, the District of Columbia versus Heller. My understanding was that to some extent that was, as a constitutional lawyer, I'm sure you're aware of Supreme Court shopping. How much was that case shopped? How much did the advocates on the part of Heller want this brought to the courts?
Well, they absolutely. This was a case, District of Columbia against Heller, and it was designed to get the Supreme Court to rule on what the meaning of the Second Amendment is. It's kind of surprising that 200-some years after the Bill of Rights was adopted, the Supreme Court had really never made crystal clear what the main purpose of the Second Amendment was. And so this was very well-thought-out strategic litigation in the model of the civil rights movement. The lawyers went out and recruited very sympathetic plaintiffs. You know, most gun cases in the past were involved some criminal who had been raised a Second Amendment question as part of a desperate set of appeals. But United States against Crackhead was not a good vehicle to interpret the Second Amendment. So they went out and got sympathetic plaintiffs, and they pursued this case in the hopes of getting the Supreme Court to rule on it. In fact, one of the interesting stories I found in writing Gunfight was that the NRA opposed this lawsuit from the very beginning because they did not want the Supreme Court to rule on this issue. They were afraid of losing, obviously, a conservative Supreme Court striking down their view of the Second Amendment. But some also suspected they were afraid of winning, that they didn't want their crisis-driven fundraising techniques to be called into question when the Supreme Court said, hey, government can never come take away all your guns.
So to somebody that, you know, I wasn't born here, so sometimes I'm puzzled by how the Constitution is fought over and reinterpreted. And as you know, there's many arenas in which people argue about it. People that are religious say that the Founding Fathers were ruling in favor of them, and others are saying, wait a minute, the Founding Fathers were actually deists. And you know, there's endless numbers of arguments. But if just in my reading of the Second Amendment, it seems fairly straightforward that the predicate is the state shall have well-regulated militias and the citizens' rights to bear arms shall not be infringed. But the predicate seems to be the state shall have well-regulated militias. Now, how did this ruling then reverse that to make that the least important and certainly not the context and the second part, the law of the land?
Well, it's kind of complicated because what the framers meant by a militia was not what we might mean today as a militia. We think of the militia perhaps as being the National Guard, an organized, select group of people who might help out with national defense. But remember, the Founding Fathers feared a standing army. They feared an organized militia. What they wanted was a well-regulated militia, but what they were referring to was a citizen's militia. We, the people, who would fight for national defense. When called out, we would go home and grab our guns and show up to fight. That's the so-called Minutemen. But one of the things I talk about in Gunfight was that the Founding Fathers, they wrote the Second Amendment, but they also had gun control. They barred large portions of the population from possessing guns, and they had restrictive militia laws that heavily regulated gun owners, including requiring them to appear at public musters where their guns would be inspected and registered on state rolls. They even had a version of the individual mandate, you know, that's proven so controversial in Obama's health care reform, the provision that requires people to go out and buy health insurance. Well, the Founding Fathers passed the Militia Act of 1792. It mandated individuals to go out and buy guns so that they could fight for the national defense should need be.
Again, I'm speaking with Adam Winkler, who is a professor of constitutional law at the University of California and the author of the new book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. So I guess the first big irony here is that gun control got underway as your book, which really does tell the whole historical story, not just the Founding Fathers' role, but the end of the Civil War during Reconstruction. There was a fear on the part of the white Southerners that the newly freed slaves would have arms. And curious enough, your book, Gunfight, reveals that the Ku Klux Klan was one of the, you know, the first advocates of gun control.
Well, before the Civil War, blacks in the South were never allowed to own guns. But during the war, blacks got their hands on guns for the first time. Some served in black units of the Union Army, and the Union Army allowed them to take their guns home. Others just purchased guns on the black market, which was flooded with firearms produced for the war effort. Racist whites began to form posses like the KKK that would go out at night, terrorizing blacks, invading their homes, with the purpose of taking those guns away. Whites knew that if they disarmed the freedmen, they wouldn't be able to fight back. And one of the things I show in Gunfight is that the history of guns in America has been deeply intertwined with issues of race and racism.
And another little irony here is that people, as you point out, that there's a lot more to this story than gun nuts versus gun grabbers. The simplistic way that most of the arguments over gun control have panned out, and obviously there's much more texture here and much more history and much more nuance, but one of the other ironies here, Adam Winkler, is that Ronald Reagan, a conservative, also brought about gun control in part because the Black Panthers scared the hell out of a lot of white conservatives.
That's right. In Gunfight, I tell the story of one, I think, of the most amazing spectacles in the history of the gun debate. And it was in May 1967 when 30 members of the Black Panthers marched into the California Capitol building openly carrying loaded rifles, pistols, and shotguns. They weren't there to commit violence. They were there to protest a proposed gun control law, a proposed gun control law that was being promoted by conservatives in California who were seeking to disarm the Panthers. In fact, the 1960s saw a number of gun control laws enacted to restrict access to guns by blacks, laws that were supported by, like you say, Ronald Reagan. And ironically, these laws fueled the rise of the modern gun rights movement, a movement that is famous for being white, rural, and politically conservative.
So when did it change then, in the sense that the lines are pretty much drawn now where it's liberal, urban, female voters on the Democratic side? I think the champion of gun control is California Senator Dianne Feinstein. So when did it switch from the conservative to the liberal side?
Well, things really switched in the early 1970s. As I mentioned earlier, the NRA used to be a big supporter of gun control law. And what happened was is that after the laws of the 1960s, the modern gun rights movement rose along with the general rise of the new conservatism, or the new right, as it's often called, that propelled Ronald Reagan to the White House in 1980. And the NRA actually undergoes a coup by a group of hardline members who take over at the annual meeting in 1977, oust the entire board, put their own people in place, and recommit the NRA to a hard-line view of the Second Amendment. So things really changed in the 1970s, in part in response to the laws that were designed to disarm the Black Panthers. White conservatives thought the government was coming to get their guns next.
So it's this almost describing a kind of Tea Party takeover of the Republican Party. Is that an analogy? Because I remember talking to a former counsel of the NRA who wrote a book basically saying that he broke with the leadership because they were too extreme, that they were using excessive paranoia as a fundraising tool, and that they were in many ways out of step with some of their rank and file. I believe there was a poll done suggesting that I think the majority of NRA members actually would favor some sensible gun control.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the majority of gun owners out there would support more and more effective gun control laws. But I tell you why they don't, and because I think they're really convinced that the government is coming to take their guns away. And I think one of the things that I think my friends on the liberal side should do is not fight so much to get rid of all the guns. If liberals can accept that there is a basic right of self-defense that involves a firearm, I think that will do much in the long run to calm the waters of the gun debate. Now, of course, the other side has to compromise as well, and maybe not push to have guns on campuses or not push to have guns on airplanes, as some have even suggested we should have, because, you know, that would be great to have a shootout at 10,000 feet if someone tried to commit some criminal act out there. At least that's what they suggest. So I think both sides need to compromise, but it's true that we have been sort of dominated in this country by the extremes on both sides, and that the answer, the story of guns in America, is actually much more balanced and much more nuanced. We've always had gun rights, but we've also always had gun control.
Well, of course, what tends to happen, though, with the political debate, the gun control people tend to get a bit of wind in their sails when there's some horrible massacre, the latest of which was the Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. And of course, it's no small irony that the Republican Party down in Arizona recently gave out a Glock similar to the one that was used to shoot Gabrielle Giffords, kill a federal judge, and kill a young child and a bunch of other people. I think they may maybe later apologize for it not being in the best of taste. But one of the things that the gun rights people say, and I believe it's very effective, it's like the argument over torture, you know, the ticking bomb. We have to torture people because of the ticking bomb, even though people inside the government that I've spoken to, like the FBI guy in charge of going after Al-Qaeda and a CIA guy I spoke with recently, they all say that it's absolutely nonsensical. It nevertheless resonates with the public. And I think, as far as I can tell, what resonates with the public is when there is a mass shooting, what the NRA say, if only somebody there had had a gun, they could have stopped it. And I remember speaking to the young fellow that was shot at Virginia Tech, who very, very eloquently, totally devastated that argument. But there was a case recently in a shootout in Texas where some National Guardsmen were killed. and apparently somebody did have a gun, but the guy that was shooting everybody had an AK-47, and the guy, I think, had a pistol, and he figured he was outmatched and didn't want to use it.
That's right. It seems hard for me to believe that we're going to increase public safety by encouraging people to shoot, to take out their guns and start gunfights with some mass shooter out there. I don't think that's likely to be very effective, and especially it could be a problem for police who then have to sort out a situation and come restore order, and they don't know who is the killer and who is the person who's coming to everyone's defense. So it can really mess things up. At the same time, I think there is something to be said about the idea that having schools like I'm at UCLA declaring that a gun-free zone, it's not really a gun-free zone. I mean, it's just by law you're not allowed to have a gun here, but we don't search anyone's backpack when they come on campus. So calling it a gun-free zone does not really make it a gun-free zone. And so if there is a legitimate reason to have a gun for self-defense in public, and many people will disagree about that, but if there is such a reason, then declaring an area a gun-free zone probably is not going to work to keep the bad guys from having guns either. So, again, I think both sides in the gun debate are probably a little bit wrong about this, and that the answer is really coming up with better and effective gun control laws that might actually work. Not passing a law because we're in the emotional throes of some kind of crisis because there's been some shooting. We don't get great legislation there. We wouldn't get great legislation, anti-terror legislation, after 9/11. That's the wrong time that you want to try to come up with good, thoughtful, effective laws.
Well, just in closing, though, Adam Winkler, you point out in your new book, Gunfight, that much of the mythology about the Wild West is completely off point, that gun violence was actually rare and restrictive gun control was quite commonplace in the West. So I guess, to some extent, does that point the finger at Hollywood? Because, you know, I can't get by without seeing a poster of some pretty young blonde holding a big gun that she's clearly uncomfortable with. Every movie poster has a gun pointing at you, almost.
Well, I come from a Hollywood family, so I don't want to put the blame there. But we do all know the
image. But you agree with me, though. Have
of a gunslinger walking around a Wild West town, six shooters on each hip, a rifle in each hand, as a duel on Main Street every day at noon. But one of the remarkable things I discovered in writing Gunfight was that our popular understanding of the Wild West couldn't be more inaccurate. The frontier towns, places like Dodge City, Deadwood, Tombstone, had the most restrictive gun laws in the nation. Everyone had guns out in the untamed wilderness, but when you came into town where the civilized folk lived, you had to check your guns like you'd check your coat at a Boston restaurant in winter. And it turns out there was very little gun violence in these towns, which saw an average of less than 2 murders a year. Turns out that there really wasn't much reason to get out of Dodge.
Well, notwithstanding that, at least in my experience, I've seen a million posters with a gun pointed at you. But isn't there an association, not that psychologically the guns actually solve problems, which I think is a very destructive kind of social lesson to propagate, but I'm just curious to know why guns are associated with manliness and solving problems. Because, for example, in Australia, where I come from, if anybody pulled a gun out at a fight, they would be considered absolutely disgusting and a completely cowardly worm of an individual that real men use their fists. So in terms of gun control, is there any way that dissociation between guns and solving problems and being manly could be broken? Because it seems ultimately to be unhealthy.
I think you're right. It is unhealthy. Ironically, by the way, some of our earliest gun control laws were passed in southern states specifically designed to stop people from pulling out a gun at the slightest sign of dishonor and entering into a duel. In the old days, it used to be thought that carrying a concealed weapon was the kind of thing only a scoundrel would do. Today, however, the gun rights movement really promotes concealed carry of firearm and tries to liberalize the laws so that everyone can have a gun out on the street hidden from view. So certainly, like so many things about the story of guns in America, things are much different today than they once were. And by perhaps looking back at the past and seeing how we've balanced gun control and gun rights, maybe we can start to change the dynamics of the gun debate in America.
Thank you again for joining us, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Adam Winkler, the author of the new book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking about the musical chairs in the Kremlin, how Putin has suddenly stepped out of the shadow of his puppet Medvedev who's the current president, to reassume the role as the next president of Russia, a role he never really relinquished. We were joined by Nina Khrushcheva, who's a relative of the former Soviet leader Khrushchev. She's a professor in international relations at the New School, and somebody that is really up on what's going on in Russia. Clearly, she's got very good connections. And essentially, the West has been deluding itself about Putin. They just don't want to believe what is really obvious, that the guy's a gangster, that he runs KGB Incorporated, that he regulates the theft of Russia through by the KGB and by the crony billionaires, or the authorized billionaires. And the minute one billionaire doesn't play ball with the Kremlin, he goes to jail, like the head of Yukos, Khodorkovsky. So I eventually asked her, I said, well, does this mean that we're not wrong in being delusional? Because if you really, face up to it, there's so much evidence about Putin's role in starting the Second Chechen War, in the murder of the journalist Anna Politkovskaya, the use of polonium, the radioactive isotope to kill a KGB defector in London, all of the evidence that maybe Putin's been, giving the orders like a mafia boss. And she said, yes, at the end of the day, you have to pretty much accept that he is a killer, and he is running a group of killers, and that he probably will end up with the same fate as Beria, the head of the KGB under Stalin, and that he stays in there because he has to regulate the killers before they kill him. Then we spoke with Bob Stern, president of the Center for Governmental Studies, about this extraordinary case here in California where a local accountant has fleeced the campaign funds of most of the top Democratic office holders, including the Senator Feinstein and Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez. 400 bank accounts have been frozen. Millions of dollars have disappeared. And this, we were looking into how much this is going to affect some of the important races here in California. These office holders are going to have to go back to their donors. They're trying to get special exemption. So it's an amazing, it's amazing how she got away with it for so long, this crooked accountant. And then finally, we talked with Adam Winkler, who's got his new book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And there was actually some fascinating information I hadn't heard about before. I didn't realize that gun control actually was started during Reconstruction by racist Southerners who were afraid that the free slaves would get guns. The Ku Klux Klan, of all people, began as a gun control organization, and that the modern gun rights movement was inspired by a fear of the Black Panthers, Ronald Reagan being one of the champions of that movement. So, very interesting. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.